And I find that, though, in talking to people, they don't know maybe as much about the velopharyngeal mechanism, anatomically speaking. And to be honest, I didn't exactly know what I should be preparing for, you know, in coming here. And so what I'd like to do now, this afternoon, is talk about velopharyngeal anatomy and physiology, because I'm not sure that, you know, I don't know how much you've had in this. And if you've already had all of the things I'm talking about, let me know, and then we can talk about something else. I understand that tomorrow morning I'll be speaking probably to the same group, okay? And so what I was thinking was we could talk about some of the background information, you know, with regard to anatomy and physiology, and then tomorrow I will be talking about diagnostics and the treatment. Does that sound okay? All right. And why is it important to know about anatomy? Number one, we ourselves as speech people need to know about how the body functions, you know, for speech. And in this case, specifically for velopharyngeal activities, because it's so very important in cleft lip and palate. I'm not going to be talking about the respiratory mechanism of the larynx. You know, that, like I said, that would be way beyond the scope of what we're trying to accomplish here. So it's important in its own right that we as speech people have a good understanding of this so that we understand how people talk and how they control the velopharyngeal mechanism. But beyond that, I think it's very important for us to understand the anatomy so that we can communicate with our medical staff, especially with our surgeons. Okay, there are a couple of reasons for that. I hope you understood or appreciated yesterday when we were seeing patients that all three of us were interacting, you know. And in order to interact, especially with our surgeons, we need to convince them, so to speak, that we know about anatomy, you know, because if we as speech people come across as, I don't know anything about the anatomy, we're going to lose credibility with our surgeon colleagues. But if they understand that we know about anatomy and physiology, we will gain respect, and they will respect us, okay? Otherwise, they're going to ignore us, you know, and think, yeah, we're not important, you know. And if we gain their respect and their credibility, then we as speech people become actual functioning members of the cleft palate team, you know. And if not, they're going to ignore us, you know. But they should not ignore us, because we as speech people are the experts in speech. And after all, people born with cleft palate need our help, you know. They need us to be their advocate, you know, for good speech. And we're the ones that would have to say, look, speech is important, you know. Let's not disregard it, all right? So that's kind of where I'm coming from. And I will go ahead and proceed. And so again, if you know all this, you know, let me know, and we can kind of talk about something else. And also, as we're going along here, feel free to ask questions, okay? Because it's important that we kind of communicate with each other. That's what we do, you know. We are experts in communication. So if we cannot communicate among ourselves, then we can't communicate with our patients or our other medical staff and so forth. So, okay. I'm sorry, say that again.
Would you like to help you or not?
I'm okay, yeah. And maybe if we could lower the lights a bit. Now, it doesn't have to be real dark, but the lights, if we could lower the look. Yeah.
Wait a minute, you want to take
your feet off your unit next to me?
Oh, okay.
Sure.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to say was if anybody's interested in doing research, you know, we should be part of the research endeavors. Because, again, for the same reason, we are the experts in speech. And personally, I've done a lot of research that involves this very area, you know, the anatomy of the velopharyngeal mechanism. I've done a lot of that myself. I've published a lot in this area. But my students have, too. And now I'm proud and happy to say that a lot of the students that I taught over the years are themselves now doing research and publishing and involved in teams in various places. So, and I am also happy to say that I've worked a lot with Fatemeh Derakhshande in Isfahan, and we're going to see her again on Monday. So I'm very happy to do that, and I feel good that she and I have had a chance to interact quite a bit over the years. And I'm happy to say, too, that she's been so successful in bringing together a team of specialists. And that's pretty remarkable because I think, again, in many countries, speech pathologists don't have the kind of respect that and credibility that we should have. So I'm so happy for her and happy for people here in Iran that she is able to kind of pull together a team, and I hope we can do that. I help with other teams in other places as well. Okay, are we ready to start here? All right. So let me start right away and with a picture that you've seen before. And this is a normal velum, and it's a picture that I was able to get of a normal individual, and he was saying the word ma, just like that, ma, and sustaining the ah vowel. Now, a couple of things we should note here, that as Dr. Sommerlett said earlier, if we look in the mouth and then have the person say ah, you know, that will tend to elevate the velum, but if we only say a sustained ah, the velum will not necessarily make full contact. But the reason I use this particular sound is to show you the outline of the normal soft palate. Okay, this is a beautiful portrayal of a normal velum. And as we've heard so many times already, the levator muscle attaches right about there. You can actually see the shadow of the levator. And when it contracts, it pulls the velum up and back. And so you can see that even if we cut off the uvula completely, there's still the possibility of perfect contact because the uvula is a structure that contains a lot of glands, mucus secreting glands, and blood capillaries and such. It's kind of a warming device of sorts, but it's not absolutely necessary for speech. So if you look in the mouth and you don't see a uvula necessarily, that's okay. That doesn't necessarily mean that speech is going to be abnormal. And even if you have a bifid uvula, that still might be okay for the same reason. So the uvula might be bifid or split, but as long as the musculature up here is intact, it's probably okay. There are actually some cultures in which the uvula is cut off. It's cut off on purpose for religious purposes. It's like a religious ritual. And as long as there is not infection, as long as the soft palate is not infected, speech is usually okay. All right. But we are so, the lateral view x-ray is so important to us. And when I go to developing countries, which is a lot, I go to a lot of places, poor countries, and if there are no diagnostic instruments at all, for example, if they do not have endoscopy or some of these other procedures that we heard about this morning, almost all of these places, I would say maybe all of them, have an x-ray department, in their hospital. And the x-ray department is probably used for, assessing broken bones and maybe chest x-rays and that sort of thing, and that's fine. But they may never have used x-rays to evaluate the soft palate mechanism. And that's one of the first things that I ask when I go to a country that's fairly poor, and maybe a poor area. I say, look, I would like to go down to your radiology department with a patient and show you how we can take an x-ray that will provide us with some useful information. And so what we will do then is to take usually just two x-rays. One x-ray will be taken with the patient with teeth closed, with the jaw closed, and simply breathing through the nose. And that would give us an impression then of the soft palate which lies on top of the tongue dorsum when one is breathing through the nose. Okay? Fine. So we see the soft palate in rest condition lying on the tongue if they're just breathing through their nose with the mouth closed. But then I also get an x-ray with the patient sustaining a fricative. Okay, in our country, the sustained S sound is very good. And usually the radiology, the x-ray technician, doesn't quite understand speech. So if you tell them, if you just say that I want another x-ray with sustained S sound, you know what they'll do? They'll tell the patient to say S, you know. That's not what we want, because S is a syllable, you know, it's a vowel and a consonant. So no. You have to demonstrate. You have to say, please have the patient do the following, and then demonstrate. Okay? Please have the patient go like this. You know, and show them we want to sustain the S sound. And what that will provide then is the soft palate elevated. And, you know, in a normal situation, the soft palate will be contacting the posterior pharyngeal wall. If there's a very large gap there, that provides some information for you and so forth. You can see that if the soft palate is long enough and these sorts of things. So those two x-rays provide a lot of information. And if that's all we go by to supplement whatever we hear, that's still some very useful information. Another thing that we can find from lateral x-rays is the amount of adenoid tissue. So, for example, I think I have a couple more that I can show you later on, but in some children, the adenoid tissue is very pronounced and might itself be almost contacting the velum. And as a result of that, the velum would not have to elevate so far, you know. So if you're looking in the child's mouth and you say the sound ah, you may not see very much movement. And the reason is because it is already contacting, you know, the adenoid tissue, which is going to be convex, okay? Now, if you've got a very short velum and it's making contact with the adenoid tissue, you for sure don't want to recommend removing the adenoid. We're very, very conservative in that regard. We don't want to remove the adenoid tissue because so many times it's aiding velopharyngeal closure. But it also can give you some predictive information. Because if you have a very short, soft palate and it's making contact with a very large adenoid pad, for sure you want to follow that patient as he or she gets older. Because the normal situation is that the adenoid tissue will eventually get smaller. So usually by the time the child is 12, 13, 14 years of age, that adenoid tissue atrophies, it involutes, it gets smaller. And what could happen then is if the velum is too short, it may lose the ability to make contact, and hypernasality could develop at a later age. You know, when I see something like that in our patients, I always make a point to say we have to follow this person because it's likely that speech will get worse as the child gets older. Not get better, it'll get worse in terms of hypernasality. Dr. Sommerlad this morning mentioned the early work of Dr. Leon Skolnick, who was a radiologist, and Dr. Skolnick made popular this taking x-rays in different projections. You know, one being a lateral view, of course, another being a frontal view, and another with what they call base view. And with that, the patient is prone on the x-ray table like this with head way back, and the x-ray beam is going up through here and going up to the sensor. And then you have a view like this, looking through the velopharyngeal orifice. Now, of course, nowadays, we can accomplish the same thing using endoscopy. So we, as I guess I should stop saying as Dr. Sommerlad said, because I'll probably say it 100 more times today. So I'm not going to keep repeating that. But we don't usually do this kind of view so much anymore because we get the same information from endoscopy, which is very common these days. But I like this picture because it shows the configuration at rest with the velum basically in a lowered position. You see the convexity on top of the nasal surface of the velum. And then in this view, the velum is starting to rise, and we still have an opening there. But in this view, the velum is completely elevated, making contact with the posterior pharyngeal wall. And he made a big point of saying, you know, this is not just a trap door, you know, like a door opening and closing, but rather it's more of a sphincter, you know, where there's, closure from the front and from the sides, not so much from the back, but mostly from the front and the sides. If we're getting some contribution from the posterior pharyngeal wall, that's referred to as a passivance ridge or a passivance pad, where the back wall of the throat bulges forward. It's not that common. We see it occasionally in cleft palate children, but in normal individuals, it's very rare because it's not needed. Most of the closure is achieved by the velum raising and being pulled backwards. All right. This is the muscle that's the most important muscle in achieving velopharyngeal closure. Let me show you some different views here. excuse me. What I did here was that we dissected... Okay. You know, imagine this. This is on a cadaver, obviously. But imagine this. Imagine you've removed the back part of the head, and you've removed the cervical vertebrae, and now you are looking down at the soft palate as if you were inside the person's pharynx, looking down at it. Okay? And so here we see the nasal septum, and we're looking forward now, you know, if you can imagine that. We're looking forward into the two nasal passages. This is the middle turbinate, okay? And somebody asked the other day, you know, how shall we pass the endoscope? And my answer to him was through the so-called middle meatus. There are three turbinates, and the one you aim for is to pass it through the middle meatus, the middle channel, because then you can be looking down at the soft palate. If you try to pass the endoscope along the floor of the nose, you don't get a favorable bend. You don't get a favorable bend of the endoscope to view downward. So it's better to raise it up a little bit so you're looking down at the velopharyngeal orifice. Okay? Now, the other thing we see here is this is the uvula, okay, the bottom part of the velum. It's called the uvula. It's the structure that hangs freely at the bottom of the soft palate. But look at where the levator sling is. Here's the levator bundle on the one side, the right side, and here's the levator bundle on the other. And the two levator bundles come into kind of the middle portion of the soft palate. And I think you can appreciate that when the levator muscle contracts, these two bands of muscle pull the soft palate up and back, okay? And that is the primary muscle for closing off the velopharyngeal mechanism in normal individuals. I showed this view earlier in my talk this morning, and we are doing a lot of MRI work, magnetic resonance imaging, at my university and my hospital. And I like this view because it very nicely shows the levator sling, you know, from the origin on one side of the skull, it's at the base of the skull, and then the origin on the other side. And we see the levator muscle coming through the soft palate right there. Okay. And, you know, MRI, as I mentioned this morning, is the only procedure in which we can actually visualize muscle tissue. And the great advantage there is that we can image living subjects. You know, prior to MRI, the only way we could study the anatomy was with cadavers, you know, and cadavers don't talk, you know, so we get still impressions. But with MRI, we can image living individuals, living patients, while they are talking, okay? And we have done studies in which we have measured the length of the levator muscle. We've measured the angle of origin right here, from there to there, that angle. We've measured lots of things. And so we have a better understanding now of what the muscle does, not only at rest, but also in elevation. We also know that there are differences, as you might expect, between people who are born with a cleft palate versus normals. The muscle tends to be a little smaller in people with a cleft palate. We know, too, for example, that in people with velocardiofacial syndrome, we've done some imaging in patients who have that. The muscle is not nearly as big. And so there are a lot of things going against people who have velocardiofacial syndrome, one of which is a smaller levator muscle. So there are a lot of things that are not good. And, you know, and if we're interested in other structures like the tongue, all right, here's the tongue, here's the genioglossus muscle, you know, here's the masseter muscle and so forth. So this is the part of the mandible, this is the condyle of the mandible, and on and on and on. So there are a lot of things that we can measure on MRI images. This is a schematic, a drawing taken from a rather old atlas, but it's a nice atlas. This is obviously a drawing, but this one shows you it's kind of an oblique view. Let's see if I can simulate it. Okay, so imagine turning the head a little bit like this, and we're going to bisect the head. All right, we're going to remove half of the head, and what you're looking at then is the right half of the head, and this is the eustachian tube, also called the auditory tube, and it is coming from the middle ear cavity down to the pharynx, okay? And this is part of the eustachian tube right there, and you can see where the levator muscle follows the path of the auditory tube. You see it originates at the base of the skull, and then the levator muscle is coming down like this, and eventually it inserts into the soft palate as we saw before. The levator muscle also actually crosses the eustachian tube at the pharyngeal end, so that even though a different muscle opens the eustachian tube, the levator helps, and it tends to open this part of the auditory tube by twisting it. So when the levator muscle elevates, when that sling comes up, it tends to twist this part of the eustachian tube and help to open that part of the tube. But another muscle, which we'll talk about later, the tensor muscle, opens the auditory tube along this length. Okay? You know, the levator muscle does not open the entire eustachian tube. That would be very annoying, because if it did, every time we spoke, the eustachian tube would be opened, and we would speech, the acoustic aspects of our speech, would be delivered right straight up to the middle ear cavity. That's not good. If we have a patent, an open eustachian tube, that's very distracting, you know, because normally when we hear our own voice, it goes out through the atmosphere and comes back to our ear. True, we get some bone conduction too, but if the eustachian tube is open all the time, it would, the sound would be amplified because it would go right straight to our middle ear and, you know, then along the auditory chain. So anyway, so when we swallow and when we speak, that will tend to open the this part of the eustachian tube, but not the whole eustachian tube. Okay. Yes.
Responsibility of a levatorial palate. Levatorial palate is responsible for the opening of the eustachian tube or not, or only for opening.
Only for opening, but only in a restricted area. You see, if we're going to open the entire eustachian tube along its entire length, we need another muscle to open it here. Yeah. So the answer is, it opens. Oh, okay. Thank you so much. Is there a drink of water?
I'll not be coming on it. It's on.
Yeah. Thank you, Ed. If I'm going to be talking, you know, a long time, I would rather have some water. So, yeah. Thank you. This thing doesn't work anyway. Thank you so much. Okay. Does that answer your question or not? Does that answer your question?
Yes, of course. Levatorial palate is responsible for opening the eustachian tube, okay? And tensor vellus palatini is responsible for closing.
No. Closing the eustachian tube is a mechanical factor. Maybe you'll have a better appreciation when I show you some more slides. No. So you open the tube with muscles, but you close it just by relaxing the muscles. You know, it kind of, it's almost like pulling on a spring, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you have to have a muscle to pull the spring, but once you let go of the spring, it goes back by itself. I'm sorry? It's a mechanical mechanism, yeah. Oh, speaking of that, so here's a slide I think that might help a little bit. thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. I don't know if this thing, I don't think it's working. So what we're looking at here is a cross section through the eustachian tube. So imagine the tube is coming down like this, and we're cutting through it, you know, like that, and then we're turning it so that you can look at the cut surface, okay? And this is an actual histologic slide. And so here we see the levator veli palatini right at the undersurface here of the eustachian tube. This is this eustachian tube cartilage, okay? And here is the tensor veli palatini muscle, which we'll talk about a little bit more. But this muscle is all the way along, pretty much along the length of the eustachian tube. But the levator crosses only in the area of the pharynx. Okay? Okay. Thank you. So the tensor, when it contracts, it pulls. You see there's sort of a kind of a curl here. And when the tensor muscle contracts, it pulls this cartilage laterally, and that opens the opening here. L stands for lumen, or the opening. And that is necessary to help open the tube along the entire length, most of the length anyway. And the levator muscle, when it contracts, it tends to pull the cartilage in this area that way. So the combination of the pull of levator in that direction and the pull of the tensor veli palatini in the lateral direction opens the eustachian tube. Now, when the levator contracts, when you stop talking, or when you stop swallowing, then the levator muscle will relax. You know, it won't be twisting anymore. It won't be pulling in that direction. And then when we relax, the tensor muscle will, stop pulling also. And then this spring's back closed. Okay, that's the spring mechanism that I was talking about, where this part of the cartilage then and this part come together and close the eustachian tube. Now, unfortunately, in children who are born with cleft palate, there may be foreshortened. It may not be as prominent. This part here of the eustachian tube may not be as prominent in children born with cleft palate. And the muscle, the levator muscle, might not be as strong. It might be not positioned properly. And the tensor muscle, it has an important attachment at the hamulus, and we'll talk about the hamulus later. But in the old days, surgeons used to fracture the hamulus, and that doesn't provide them a good anchor. It doesn't provide an anchor for the tensor vili palatini, pulling the cartilage this way. So for all of those reasons, children born with cleft may have a malfunctioning eustachian tube. And that then is one of the main reasons, maybe the reason, for the fact that babies born with cleft have so much in the way of ear problems. Okay, they all have middle ear fluid, which has to be dealt with. And as I said this morning, we put a tube or a grommet in the eardrum to provide aeration and hopefully some drainage also. All right, on to a different muscle now. The superior pharyngeal constrictor, which is primarily related to lateral pharyngeal wall movement. Okay, so this is an important muscle. There's another muscle too I'll talk about later. But this muscle is very important if we're considering providing a posterior pharyngeal flap. Because this is the muscle then that would constrict the lateral walls and have the lateral walls of the pharynx making contact with the pharyngeal flap. So very important muscle in that regard. And here's another drawing, once again from Grant's Atlas. And we actually have three constrictor muscles in the pharynx, kind of all lined up here. And if you're interested in swallowing, and by the way, in our country, our speech pathologists are really, really involved in swallowing disorders now. We speech pathologists have pretty much taken over that whole area of diagnosing and treating swallowing disorders. So, if we're involved in swallowing disorders, we're going to be much more interested in the inferior constrictor muscle and the middle constrictor muscle. For our purposes, we're more interested in what's going on in the upper pharynx, that being the superior pharyngeal constrictor. And all of these muscles are fan-shaped, as you can see, and they kind of embrace the pharynx and then make contact in the back wall of the throat. And here, in fact, we see the back wall of the throat. And here, this is an actual cadaver dissection. And we see the inferior constrictor down here, the middle constrictor here, and the superior constrictor right here. Now, it's not the case that the muscle fibers of the superior constrictor, they don't go all the way up to the base of the skull. Instead, they come here and they insert into a raphe. This is a kind of a septum of connective tissue septum, and that septum, that raphe, connects up to the base of the skull. So it's kind of like these fibers are attaching to, as a curtain would, to kind of a strand here. So this area of the pharynx is filled in with connective tissue, but not with muscle. Okay. And so these are the muscle fibers that we're actually talking about. This muscle here, number 10, is called the stylopharyngeus. It goes from the styloid process up here, and it inserts into the pharynx.